This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org. Edwige Dantica with Juno Diaz. Recorded in Santa Fe, November 30th, 2005. Novelist and short story writer Edwige Dantica has said of her work, "My greatest hope is that mine becomes one voice in a giant chorus that is trying to understand and express artistically what it's like to be a Haitian immigrant in the United States." In this program, she reads from her latest novel, The Dewbreaker, before joining in conversation with her friend and fellow novelist, Juno Diaz.
Good evening. How are you guys doing tonight? Yeah? I hope you're as excited as I am. It's messed up. I'm like you guys. The reason I came to introduce Edwige just so I could hear Edwige, yeah? So that's the way it should work. My name is Juno Diaz. This is an extraordinary occasion, something I'm extremely pleased to be able to introduce Edwige Dantica. Now, most of you have heard introductions before, and they usually fall under kind of the two categories, so I'm going to try to do both things, yeah? And, part one is that, the kind of the resume, the curriculum vitae one. So we'll start there, yeah? And so this is part one, and part two will be, you know, the more heartfelt one where I sound absurd reading it, yeah? So we'll do both of them, yeah? Part one. Edwige Dantica was born in Haiti in 1969 and moved to the United States when she was 12. She is the author of Dewbreaker, Breath Eyes Memory, Cri Crac, The Farming of the Bones, She, After the Dance, Behind the Mountains, Anacaona. She edited The Butterfly Ways, Voices from the Haitian Diaspora, and The Beacon Best of 2000. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker and many anthologies, and she is the co-author with filmmaker Jonathan Demme of two books on Haitian art, Islands on Fire and Odilon Pierre, a Haitian artist. She was the associate producer with Jonathan Demme on the documentary about Haiti called The Agronomist. She was nominated for the National Book Award. She received a Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Award, a James Michener Fellowship, an American Book Award. She won the Story Prize of 2004, the 2005 Annis Field Wolf Book Award. She was a finalist for the Hurston Wright Legacy Award. She was nominated for the National Book Critics Circle Award. She was a finalist for the Penn Faulkner in 2005. And the American Academy of Arts and Letters awarded her the Benjamin H.T. Danks Award in 2005 for The Dewbreaker. And this, of course, is my favorite one, yeah? And best of all, Jane Magazine named her one of the 15 gutsiest women of the year. That's the shit right there. You know, that's probably the one that Reese didn't want me to read out, yeah? I'm like, hell yeah. All right, so this is part two, all right? Here comes the absurdness, yeah? Introductions often belong to the genre of hyperbole, but I suspect I'm erring on the side of caution when I say that Edwige Dantica possesses that rarest of traits, genius. Beginning with her first award-winning novel, Breath, Eyes, Memory, and continuing straight up to her latest award-winning novel, The Dewbreaker, Ms. Dantica has produced a singular oeuvre, breathtaking in its ambition, innovative in its form, radical in its language, peerless in its execution, and shattering in its humanity. An oeuvre that has helped to return the Caribbean to its proper place at the heart of what we call literature. In my opinion, Ms. Dantica is the most important novelist in North American letters today. She is not only a great American writer, but in the words of Francisco Goldman, she is also a great writer of the Americas, who is attempting with short story, with essay, with novel, with children's narrative, with travelogue, with film, to bring about Edward Glissant's notion of a prophetic vision of the past. Ms. Dantica's subject is Haiti and the Haitian diaspora in all its stupendous variety. And what a daunting subject this is. Haiti, once the most profitable slave colony on the planet, which initiated, in Laurent Dubois' words, the largest slave revolt in history and the only one that succeeded. a distinction that earned it 200 years of neglect, quarantine, and outright hostility from those it wrested its freedom from. Haiti, which is not a headline or a song or a condition, but a people as complex and as endless as the sea. It is no mean feat to wrestle the history of a people while simultaneously challenging the possibility of such a history by emphasizing the voices and experiences that are never heard from, that resist easy integration into a national formula. What is most astonishing about Ms. Dantucat, though, is her willingness to enter historical aporias and return from these silences with tidings both dark and wondrous, tidings that reveal to us as much about the condition of 21st century humanity as they do about that reality we call the Haitian diaspora. Ms. Dantucat writes about blackness, about torture, about the weight of history, about childhood, about immigration, about being a daughter, about language, about the difficulty of parents, about silence, about secrets, with a singular verb, a ferocious wit, a capacious generosity of spirit, and with an aesthetic that brings lyricism from the mundane, the cruel, the banal, the absurd, and the impossible. She is, in other words, a mayimbe, or in a more colorful turn of a phrase, the real deal. I am a fiction editor at a small magazine. When I was asked once to compose a small blurb describing the kind of work I hope to publish, I wrote that I was seeking work that possesses the quality of Toni Morrison's 30 Mile Woman, who, if you remember the book, that's Sixto's love interest in Beloved, yeah, about whom Sixto says, "She is a friend of my mind. She gather me, man. The pieces I am, she gather them and give them back to me in all the right order." When I quoted Ms. Morrison, I had Edwige Dantucat explicitly in mind, because beyond the demands of nation, of history, of representation, of race, of literature, her prose is capable of that wondrous alchemy of reorganizing us and handing us back to ourselves in all the right order. Please join me in welcoming Edwige Dantucat. Good luck, Frank.
Good evening. Thank you for spending your evening with us, and thank you, Juno, for that wonderful introduction. Juno and I go way back, maybe about 10 years. It's always pointed out that we come from the same, you know, we are both from Hispaniola, so we share an island, but at times in our, when we were just beginning, I felt like we shared one soul, and other people would always pair us together for readings and such, and I was just, as I was coming down the stairs, I remembered and reminded him that we were once reading in Texas, where he had done his reading, and it was my turn to read, and I read, and afterwards come to find out that someone had a heart attack in the audience while I was reading, and I didn't notice there was EMS, but it became a kind of strange joke to people who were there that I was reading so intently I didn't even see someone dying in front of me. So I'm hoping that won't happen tonight. but these are the kinds of stories, and there are so many more that sort of when our paths cross, interesting things happen, and I was so happy that he was able to come tonight and we'll be able to have a conversation together in front of people this time, so we have to censor a little bit, but hopefully not too much. I also want to thank the folks at the Lannan Foundation who made this past year an incredible year for me. This past year was incredible in many ways, incredible and unbelievable, incredible and fabulous in that, you know, the year I'm closing at the end of this month, a year where I lost my uncle in a very terrible way, where he was, he had lost his house and everything in Haiti and was coming here and was detained by immigration and died in custody and was 81 years old. And then a few months later, lost my father. My father that died last May, and so it was. But in the middle of that, my daughter was born in March, and so I had this sort of year of where I think I might have been frozen still. But last year, on this day exactly, I received this award from the foundation that was able to keep me working and thinking and able to pause and regroup. So I'm very grateful to the foundation for that and for the opportunity to be with you tonight. What I will do, I'll read a story from The Dewbreaker, which is my last book. And The Dewbreaker is a series, it's nine stories, all centered around one central character of a man who I call the Dewbreaker. But the expression in Creole that is translated by this term is Chouquet Laozé. And a Chouquet Laozé is basically a man, a character in a rural section, chef de section, we call them a section chief, who was pretty much judge, jury, and executioner in a particular area, and usually was used that authority. Many of these people use that authority in a very bad way, to harm people. So, and the expression Chouquet Laozé or Dewbreaker came from the fact that they often came at the break of dawn, just as the dew was setting on the leaves. So this, I'd always had that term in mind even before I had a story for it, because growing up during the dictatorship, it amazed me sometimes how gentle the language was that we used to name or to label such cruelty. And so this is where the title of the book comes from. And there's the Dewbreaker. This man gets his stay in the book, but his say, but there are all these other characters who are circled around him, some of whom were his victims directly and some indirectly. And the story that I'll read is called The Funeral Singer, and it's about a young woman who comes to the United States in the 1970s, and she is living on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And people are always amazed by that was possible, you know, giving the high rents there now. But there was that was one of the first pockets of the Haitian community in New York, where people would move on the Upper West Side. And still today, you can see traces of that, where people sit on the islands in the streets playing dominoes or just chatting on the summer days. So the main character of this, the narrator, Frida, the funeral singer, comes here. She is exactly as the title implies, someone, a funeral singer, someone who sings at funeral, but came to that role in the midst of her own sadness. And she takes a GED class and meets two other women who are also exiles from Haiti, but from different social stratas. One is a woman named Rezia, who's a restaurateur on the Upper West Side, and Maricel, who's an art dealer, a woman who lost her husband in Haiti. And I was trying to experiment with structure for this story, because I mean, at first I wanted it to be kind of like a song, and then it became more sort of broken up into a kind of lesson, you know, like a book that these characters would be studying, you know, and I would look at manuals for this kind of class that they were taking, and they would be broken into certain lessons. So this is broken into 14 weeks, which is the 14 lessons of the journey. And that little baby you hear now and then is mine. But I'll just say to her, baby, mommy will still be here when you wake up, so sleep, okay? The Funeral Singer, week one. Rezia, the owner of Ambiance Creole, the sole Haitian restaurant on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, recites a long speech from the class manual. 4 scones and 7 tears ago, our fathers blew up this condiment. Odd, but Rezia doesn't have her lips when she attempts to speak English. Everything just gets mixed up in her mouth like a bird call in a storm. Rezia always carries a white muslin handkerchief. As it flaps back and forth ever so abruptly, it releases more and more of its vetiver fragrance, all the while looking like a kite that she's using to send messages far away. In spite of Rezia's vetiver, the air in the classroom is scorching and it stings. The air conditioner has stopped humming as if to listen to us talk. Maricel, who's shaped like a pencil, even in her heavy French suit, stands up in a perfectly straight line, and in her deep voice that sounds like two people speaking, simply states her name. She says it so quickly that it sounds shorter, as though she's given herself a nickname solely for the purposes of the class. She's asked to repeat her name, and after a third time, she announces each syllable, and they merge into two beautiful words, Marie-Sel, Salt Mary, or Solitary Mary. You're tempted to add, pray for us, and I do, under my breath. I wish I could sing to introduce myself. Perhaps everyone would be listening too hard to look at me. I would sing Brother Timony. It's a song my father, a fisherman, used to sing whenever he thought a storm was coming. I'd begin by asking everyone to pretend they were rowing with me, and I'd sing, Brother Timony, row well, my friend. Don't you see we're in trouble? Brother Timony, the wind's blowing hard, and we must make it back to land. This is not the first time I've called on Brother Timony. At least, it's not the first time I've tried. I asked my father once, who was Brother Timony? He didn't know. Maybe a fisherman who died at sea. Most of the songs he knew were about people who died at sea. When I stand to speak, the teacher decides to turn my introduction into an inquisition. And what do you do? I do nothing, I want to say. I've been expelled from my country. That's why I'm here in this class at 22 years old. Once we're all done, the teacher presents herself saying, I'm June. You can call me June. If you pay attention and study hard, the test will be a piece of cake and you'll be considered high school graduates in no time. She looks young and beefy and flat-chested and sits on the desk with her bare cream legs dangling in front of us. She doesn't know what an enormous vow she's just made. A high school diploma in no time? It's like those lawyers who promise green cards in just a few weeks. Rezia nicknames her Flat Titty. When she notices how little, like little dandelion buds, her breasts look in her pleated strapless sundress. Maricel is Mother Mary, and I'm the baby funeral singer. I'm one of the few professional funeral singers of my generation. At least I was. Week 2. When I was a girl in Leogan, some days my mother and I would play telephone. We'd tie two empty condensed milk cans to the hands of a long rope and sing to each other from far away. Sometimes I'd hide inside the house under our cedar table, and my mother would stay outside, but we could still hear each other without shouting. During carnival, we'd use our telephone rope for a maypole dance. We'd skip around each other and duck under the ropes, taking turns at being the maypole and the dancer. We always thought, or she always thought, that we were weaving the wind, plaiting it into a braid as thick as the rainbows that were sometimes above our heads. Whenever she got tired of playing, my mother would look up at the clouds and say, look, Freda, Papa's listening to us up there. He's eating coconut with God, and he's making a cloud for us with coconut meat. I thought her mind was gone whenever she said things like that. She also embroidered clouds on pieces of cloth, tiny crimson cyrus threads. My father used to look at the way the sunset outshot the clouds to decide what the sea would be like the next day. A would-be twilight would mean a calm sea, but a blood-red dawn might spoil everything. Week 3. Blue is the only color I was able to see whenever I was at sea with my father. For a while, we forgot there were other colors. Oh, I remembered yellow. Yellow like the sun almost going down. Yellow as in sunflowers and marigolds, Gizia says, fanning herself with her handkerchief and smothering us with vetiver. Marigolds, the flower of a thousand lives, Maricel adds. She puffs on her long, thin gauloise, covering the filtered tips with her mandarin red lipstick. Yellow, like my boyfriend, Izia says, the man of a thousand lies. The teacher shows us a picture of a painting full of sunflowers and says, look, look how there are no dead spots in this painting. Life is full of dead spots. I used to wear only new black dresses so I could blend in at the funerals where I sang. Now I wear used clothes, Kennedy's we call them, and rainbow colors, and a red headband around my head to brighten all my dead spots. Week 4. It was Gizia's idea that she, Maricel, and I go to a restaurant after class. We didn't always understand what was going on in the classroom, and being the only Haitians, we thought we might be able to explain certain lessons to one another, like grammatical rules for present perfect, which at first I thought meant perfect present or matchless gifts. Flowered plastic sheets were draped over the tables in the dining room, but Asia would uncover one table so we would drink on the new-looking wooden surface. The walls around us were all covered with bright little paintings, portraits of young boys playing with tops and marbles and flying kites, old men casting nets in the ocean, women walking barefoot to the market with large baskets on their head. There was a dusty fan overhead that Asia said was only turned on when the cook burned the food and she needed to air out the place. We put on the fan and sat with our knees touching because the table was so small. Only Maricel would pull her chair away, putting a few inches between us and herself. I was the one who started it one night over a bottle of urine-colored rum from Asia's pantry. Maricel would only have red wine, small bottles of Pinot Noir, which she bought herself. I used to play telephone with my mother, I said. I forgot all colors except blue when I went fishing with my father. I was asked to sing at the National Palace, you know. I thought that exposing a few details of my life would inspire them to do the same, and slowly would it all parcel out our sorrows, each walking out with fewer than we had carried in. Week 5. Before my father was arrested, the President of the Republic would drive through my town on New Year's Eve and throw money from the window of his big, shiny black car. Sun rays would wrap themselves around the brand new coins, making them glow like glass. When we heard that the President was coming, we would all clean our houses, dust our tables, and my father would stay home from the sea just in case the President chose to get out of the car and walk into our house to offer us something extra, a bag of rice, a pound of beans, a gallon of corn oil, or a promise of future entrance to the medical school or the agricultural school, something that would have bought our loyalty forever, so that 20, 30, 40 years after he was long dead, we might all be still be saying, things were hard, but we once had a president who gave me a sack of rice, some beans, and a gallon of cooking oil. It was the first and last time anyone in power gave me anything. As if this sack of rice, this pound of beans, this gallon of cooking oil were the gold, silver, and bronze medals in the Poverty Olympics. Week 6. 2 trees, 10 feet apart. The teacher writes this on the board, turning around to look at our baffled faces. 2 trees, 10 feet apart. The taller tree stands 50 feet tall and casts a 20-foot shadow. The shorter tree casts a 15-foot shadow. The sun is shining on each tree from the same angle. How tall is the shorter tree? Now, this sounds like a riddle that would take a lifetime to solve. We have too much on our minds to unravel these types of mysteries, so I give up. Well, we're not God, Gizya says. Who are we to know how tall a tree should be? Week 7. Tonight we cook an entire meal together. Maricel fries the plantains and ends up with a hide-all burn on the knuckle of her middle finger. Rezia makes the meat, stewed goat. I cook the rice with pigeon peas. We finally talk about what brought us here. Maricel left because her husband, a painter, had painted an unflattering portrait of the president, which was displayed in a gallery show. He was shot leaving the show. I was asked to leave the country by my mother because I wouldn't accept an invitation to sing at the National Palace. But I also left because long ago my father had disappeared. He'd had a fish stall at the market, and one day someone came to take it over, and another one took my father away. When my father returned, he didn't have a tooth left in his mouth, and one night they had turned him into an old, ugly man. The next night he took his boat out to sea, and with a mouthful of blood, he vanished forever. I remember the exact moment I learned about my father's disappearance. I was lying in bed when I felt the thin cotton sheet covering my body rise. My mother hadn't brought any light into the room, but I could see her clearly, a splinter of moonlight reflected in the tears falling down her face. "Your papa is across the waters, Lord Bordeaux," she whispered. And in my mind had sprouted images of my father lost at sea, rowing further and further away, until he became as small as a leaf bobbing on the crest of the most distant wave. This is when I began to sing, so he could hear me, my father, singing his songs from the crest of that wave. This is Rezia's story. When she was a girl, her parents couldn't afford to keep her, so they sent her to live with an aunt who ran a brothel. They lived in three rooms behind the brothel, and that's where Rezia spent most of her time. One night when she was sleeping, a man walked in, and she dug herself into the bed, but it did no good, so she passed out. I can always make myself faint when I'm afraid, Rezia says proudly, fanning the smoke from the pots away from her face. When I woke up in the morning, my panties were gone. My aunt and I never spoke about it, but on her deathbed, she asked for my forgiveness. She said that this man had threatened to put her in prison if she didn't let him have me that night. Week 8. Marisol brings in newspapers that we scour for news from home. She reads one report about a group of armed exiles, a New York-based militia planning an invasion. Another about a radio reporter in Port-au-Prince being arrested and taken to the Caserne des Salines barracks for questioning. Marisol reads all this to us in a deep, well-paced voice that sounds like it should be on the radio. When she comes across a name that she recognizes, she puts the newspaper down, closes her eyes, and wipes the lipstick of her mouth with the back of her hand. "I went to school with him," she would say. "I knew his brother. His father and mine were friends." Week 9. We fail our practice test, except Rezia, who gets 70%, enough to pass. "It's not normal," I complain. "We studied just as much as you did." Listen to the baby funeral singer," Marisol says, wrapping her manicured hands around the neck of her dark green wine bottle. "You have so much time ahead of you. You have your whole life to redo these things. We take these silly tests. We shape your whole life." Week 10. We drank too much and stayed too long at the restaurant. Marisol and I have grown used to the idea that we may never get diplomas out of the class. Marisol uncorks her second Pinot Noir of the evening, but Rezia and I stick to the rum. We like the fiery bitter taste and the way it makes us foggy right away. I know I'm ruining my singing voice, but I don't care. The people inside the little paintings are beginning to sway back and forth as I drink more and more. Or is it my head that's dancing? They walk past the little borders and merge into with our shadows on the wall. "Let's talk about something cheerful," Rezia says. Her voice is slurred and she sounds sleepy. She's the most drunk of the three of us, consuming more spirits in celebration for passing yet another practice test that Marisol and I have failed. "How does a person become a funeral singer anyway?" Marisol asks. She throws her hands across my shoulders, her cigarette ashes rain on my orange Salvation Army dress. "The first time I ever sing in public was at my father's memorial mass. I sang Brother Timony, a song whose cadence rises and falls like the waves of the ocean. I sang it through my tears, and later people would tell me that my sobs reminded them of the incoming tide. From that moment on, I became a funeral singer. Every time there was a funeral, I was asked to sing. I would sing my father's fishing songs and sometimes improvise my own right there next to the coffin in front of the family at the funeral home or at the church. At other times, I would sing Ave Maria or Amazing Grace if the family requested them, but I was always appreciated and well compensated. "Tell us something cheerful," Rezia objects with a mouthful of rice. "Enough about funerals. Enough." "Well, Jackie Kennedy came to Haiti last year," Marisol perks up. She drops her empty glass on the table, breaking off a chunk at the bottom. "Who's she?" Rezia picks up the piece of glass and tosses it behind her. "The wife of President Kennedy," Marisol explains. "The President Kennedy that all the used clothes in Port-au-Prince are named after." "Oh," Rezia says, now taking swigs directly from the rum bottle. "He was such a handsome man." "She is pretty too," Marisol says. "She spoke French, you know. She lost her husband and two babies, yet she remained so beautiful. She made sadness beautiful." Pushing the damaged glass aside, Marisol describes her encounter with Jackie Kennedy. Jackie Kennedy's first husband, the president whom all the used clothes in Port-au-Prince are named after, had been dead for more than a decade when she came to Haiti. Her new husband was a Greek billionaire who'd had some business with our president. Maricel's first sighting of Jackie Kennedy was on the pier at the Port-au-Prince Harbor when Jackie Kennedy walked off an enormous yacht wearing pink Bermuda shorts, a white T-shirt, a massive straw hat, and wide-rimmed sunglasses to guard her well-chiseled face. The wind almost blew her hat away, almost blew her away, as a matter of fact, Maricel recalled, but she held herself up and disembarked. My husband went to the pier to paint her portrait, Maricel says, wiping the wet glass and bottle rings off the table with her palms. He asked her what she wanted in her painting, and she said in that whispery baby voice that she wanted the harbor behind her, the cargo ships and fishing boats, and a few Haitian faces on the pier. So my husband painted her on the pier and put me in the background. So if you ever come across that painting somewhere between the Port-au-Prince Harbor and Jackie Kennedy, you will see Maricel. Week 11. My mother used to say that we will all have three deaths. The one when our breath leaves our bodies to rejoin the air, the one when we are put in the earth, and the one that will erase us completely when no one remembers us at all. I sometimes hear a dog bark, and I'm startled that it sounds a little like the dogs that roamed around me that day as I sat on the beach watching my father's fishing boat being hauled ashore without him in it. My father used to love cockfights. He enjoyed the way the men would gather in a circle and pass a bottle of rum from hand to hand as they watched. This showed that animals were much smarter than man, he used to say, the way so many of us would congregate to watch two small birds. He went to dog fights too, but he never enjoyed them. He could never get the howl of a dying dog out of his head. Week 12. When I was a girl, I had a small notebook made of a few folded sheets held together by my mother's embroidering thread. There I sketched some figures which were drawn so close together that they looked like they were fighting one another on the page. My mother was the one who thought that they were fighting. She also thought they were frightening, so she made me a rag doll because she believed I was seeing these little shadows at night and was afraid of them. Night after night, I clung to this rag doll whose crooked eyes my mother had drawn over the white cloth with a piece of charcoal. After my father was gone, I twisted the doll's neck night after night. During the day, I crowded the pages in my notebook with more tiny faces to keep me company, just in case my mother also disappeared. Week 13. Even though I've sung at a lot of funerals, I'm not necessarily a religious person. But I agree to Rezia's idea to light candles so we can pass the test. Maricel says that we should pray, but we should pray to St. Jude, the patron of lost causes. We add in there a prayer, too, for our country. It's not a lost cause yet, our country, Maricel says, because it made us. To that we toast forsaking our rum for Maricel's Pinot Noir. It feels like I'm drinking blood, not the symbolic blood of the sacraments, but real blood, velvet blood, my own blood. I give them as keepsakes a few swatches of my mother's embroidery, threads of red clouds, omens for good luck. Then Rezia asks me, why didn't you go when you asked to sing at the National Palace? Ordered, I correct her. I was ordered to go sing there. Well, why didn't you go, Rezia insists. If you had gone, maybe you'd be home now. I made a choice that I'd rather stop singing altogether than sing for the type of people who had killed my father. Isn't it amazing, Rezia says. Jackie Kennedy can go to Haiti anytime she wants, but we can't. Week 14, final week. We won't know for some time if we pass the test. Yet Rezia is still shaking with post-test anxiety when we sit down, each of us with a bowl of leftover stew from the day's menu. Maricel is wearing a set of gold bangles that, when she moves her arms, sound like the type of miniature gourd rattles you might put on a child's grave. I finally unpacked my suitcases, she says, to celebrate. She's gotten a job at a gallery not far from Lizia's restaurant and will be selling paintings, some of them her husband's. We celebrate with her by holding hands and twisting our way through the narrow spaces between the tables. And you, Frida, what are you going to do now? And out of breath, Maricel asks when we stop. I'm going back, I say, sinking into a chair. I'm going to join a militia, and I'm going back to fight. Both Maricel and Izia laugh so loud that it's all I can hear for some time. Not the fan twirling overhead or the trickle of rum and wine from bottle to glass. Look, it's the 70s, I protest. Look at Fidel Castro. He had women with him. They're still laughing, but also drinking, laughing and drinking. It's not that. Maricel is doubled over now, clinging to her belly, chortling. It's just that if you join a militia, we'll soon be reading about you. If you join a militia, you'll die. Lizia stops to wipe her damp forehead with her vetiver-scented hanky that now looks like a surrender flag. Then she asks, who will sing at your funeral? The room is quiet now except for the fan spinning overhead and a car horn blaring outside. Maricel throws her head back, empties her entire glass in her mouth, then flings it across the room. We watch it fly, then land on the wall, breaking into a torrent of little pieces. Hey! Lizia shuffles over with a broom and dustpan to pick up the shards. Don't wreck my place. If I didn't have this place, I'd be as crazy as the two of you. We're not crazy. Maricel tries to get up, but her knees buckle under her, and she falls back in her chair. Frida, why don't you do it now, Maricel says. Why don't you sing your funeral song? We'll help you. Lizia chimes in from where she's sweeping up glass across the room. I clear my throat to show them that I can do it. I'm willing to do it. I will do it. I will sing my own funeral song. And why not? And that's how I began my final performance as a funeral singer, or any kind of singer at all. I sing Brother Timony. Brother Timony, we roll on without you, but I know we'll meet again. Lizia and Maricel catch on quickly and join in. We sing until our voices grow hoarse, sometimes making Brother Timony a sister. When we've exhausted poor Timony, we move on to a few more songs, happier songs. And for the rest of the evening, we raise our glasses, broken and unbroken alike, to the terrible days behind us and the uncertain ones ahead. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Next up is the conversation.
Thank you so much. That was a superb reading, as always, Louise.
Thank you.
This is the funny part. We're going to have an authentic conversation for you guys, you know? It's not as if we don't know each other really well, too. So this will be... We'll see if this is as excruciating for y'all as it is for us, yeah? All right? But actually, I did have the question that from the moment I got the galleys for the Dewbreaker, something that was really on my mind when I first read it, and then now that I'm beginning to teach it, it's questions that come up, and one of my students begged me to ask you the question. So, and I actually had the same question. So what she asked was, why so, what she felt, so generous a portrayal of the Dewbreaker?
That's a tough one. It's actually a question that came up even in the editing process of the book, and the editor saying, do you want the Dewbreaker to be this person? But I think people who grew up in the situation that the way I grew up in a dictatorship, you know that it's not so black and white, and the perpetrators orphan people we know, and the victims are from the people closest to them. So the, I mean, like, there's so many people we went to school with, or people whose fathers you know, and so I was able to see that, you know, people, the way people are able to compartmentalize their life, and that's what I was more interested in. I wasn't so interested in good and evil, so much as sort of that space in between, you know, how between good and evil, and how someone goes from that and tries to return. And this character, the Dubricker, is someone who's trying to return to that space, you know, before. And he has this family that surrounds him who's so invested in this past of his not existing, and he's trying to live up to that. And we never see that side, and so that's the side that interested me, sort of as a fiction writer.
Did you, when you were writing it, did you find yourself leaning in one direction or another? Were you having to adjust your representation to keep that idea alive, to keep a more, you know, to kind of show that compartmentalized? Did you find yourself writing far too cruelly about the Dubricker, or underwriting it? How was some of your earlier passes when you were starting the book?
Well, the earlier passes were like, you bastard, you know?
Get him.
Yeah, it was, but I couldn't, then I realized to write authentically, like to honor the fullness of that character, the complexity of that experience, you had to feel some sympathy. So then I would write as though I were the daughter. The first story is in the first person, which is actually the story that led me into the whole, to that character, was a story called The Book of the Dead, about a young woman who's an artist who's on a trip with her father, and then he tells her the secret. So there's no mystery to the book that let's find out who the Dubricker is. So he just spills it out. He's been waiting to tell her. And then I was intrigued with him, with his struggle. But in the beginning, it's sort of, I mean, I think it's a complicated, there's so much nuance in that, you know, when people are family members of, you know, of these kind of people, and the, you know, people who do this and go home and are fathers again. And so I was as interested in the experience of the victims as the experience of the people who are closest to this person.
Right. 'Cause in the book, I mean, there's probably like three people who haven't read it here. Yeah. And they're probably like in the front row. Yeah. But, I mean, the twist in some ways, I mean, if we can call it that, I think the most heartbreaking part of the book is the relationship that the Dubricker has with his wife, right? Mm-hmm. And could you just tell us a little bit about it so that it's kind of set up the next question in a way? Mm-hmm. See, why do I got to do the work, right? Yeah, man.
The wife of the Dubricker is a woman named Anne, who
you only have to give us what you want.
Oh, okay. The Dubricker's last victim is a family member of hers, and they meet in this she's going to the prison to see about this person, and he's coming out after the horrible encounter, and then they meet in this way, and then they, because of this act that he did, now suddenly they, either one of them has anyone in the world, so they come up with, they decide this agreement where they are just together, and they produce this child. So that for me, the struggle of that character was making that a convincing choice, you know, that this a kind of desperate encounter that then grows into some kind of love, because there isn't one kind of love. And it does for the wife, and she sees herself on a mission to redeem this person, you know, to sort of claim, to make sure that he doesn't become the person he was when she met him. So that, in writing that, I mean, that was a harder character to write than the sort of the evil character. It's that person who sees herself between the horrible person in the world, and who has to constantly explain her choice, you know, and I feel like even though as an author, I have to constantly explain her choice, so, and she has to constantly explain to people. So what they do is they sort of seal themselves off as a, they become this insular unit, because they, after a while, she doesn't have the words to explain to anybody, but as she would put it, God.
Right. Well, part of the reason I ask that is because, like, I mean, for me, two things about that book is, A, kind of the strategies you selected, this forms the spine of the book by making the Dewbreaker this really nuanced character. In a way, it kind of, it doesn't permit anyone to erase the concept of that these sort of things exist in our community, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. I think that when it was like, when it's more simple, when it's black and white, it's easier to say, oh, these people are evil and they don't exist in our community. Mm-hmm. But in a way, kind of, I think I had this creepy way of implicating the entire community. Mm-hmm. The kind of decisions she makes, the kind of way that the daughter lives a life based on just hearsay. Like mm-hmm. she kind of mm-hmm. accepts what her parents tell her. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, that's a very good point. I hadn't thought about that. But I think that's true. We had, for example, a very concrete experience of a man who is named in the book of the case of a man named Emmanuel Constant, who started an organization in Haiti called FRAP that during the 1990s was responsible for the murder of something like 5,000 people. And in our societies, you know, when they say 5,000 people, it's like maybe, you know, you can triple or, you know, double or triple that.
Yeah, it's like when Americans say they're middle class.
Yeah. There's a lot of room there. So what happened with him? He then was going to, you know, was arrested, was going to be deported, and he went on 60 Minutes and said to Ed Bradley, you know, I was in the CIA. Now I'm, you know, he said, and I quote, I was a beautiful woman. They like I was a beautiful woman. They used me, and now they want to get rid of me. So for some reason, he's not been deported. You know, as or people have demonstrated in front of his house. And there was a moment where people would go to things inside the community. You would go to an art gallery, there was this man. And people, when I would talk to people about it, they would say, well, why doesn't just somebody grab him? And there is that that's sort of hard to understand, that civility almost towards these people in the new setting, that someone can feel like they can, you know, he would go to restaurants, people would see him places, and he was just this happy-go-lucky guy, until people started demonstrating in front of his house. So there was that reminder in the community that, you know, when you see, you know, people see it on the news all the time, they see the boats coming, it's not all people, not everybody is a victim in that, they're also perpetrators. And that's what the, you know, the community was made up of these layers, and there are people who go completely into the night, you know, they just live their silent lives, and others, you know, who, you know, keep that dream of going back and being president, and then they surface and they go back. And so that's a complex community, but it's a very interesting question, sort of the community's tolerance of these people, or this, maybe it's a fear that, you know, we're better off leaving that part behind, or maybe the kind of justice that's available here doesn't match, you know, what could they do anyway? I mean, there have been some lawsuits, for example, of people who were victims during the 1990s who have sued, and they've gotten these symbolic amounts of money, but there's never been that people have told of somebody grabbing somebody by the neck, and, you know, that I've ever heard of. And these people circulate in the community, you see them, nobody grabs them by the neck and says, you know, and screams at them and says, you bastard. And they're just like, oh, that people will whisper. You know, right. I have a friend who would go to a barbecue, say, oh, man, I went to a barbecue, guess who was there? And it's this guy. But or if they're still at the party, they'll say, oh, you know who that is? And they'll whisper, but nobody will go and confront the guy here.
Yeah, well, see, and that's, I think it's for me, it kind of links to some of the, I mean, I was always curious about this, because if you think about the kind of the books that you've written, the kind of the breadth of them, what attracts you in some ways to some of these stories? Because if you think about it, right, when you think about Farming of Bones, you tackle the genocide of the Haitian and Haitian Dominican community in the Dominican Republic, which is kind of this enormous historical silence, not only in the Dominican Republic, but I think in the larger Caribbean studies. Mm-hmm. I mean, people in the Caribbean studies, they're like, everyone's obsessed. You know, the bedrock of Caribbean studies, as it's formulated in the Western Academy, is like this concept of like genocide is one of the bedrocks, yeah? But there's a contemporary genocide, and very few of the scholars touch it, but you turned around and you wrote about it, but you wrote about it from the side of, on the Dominican, geographically on the Dominican side. And then you wrote about the Dew Breaker, you know, which is really, for someone inside the community, must have been counterintuitive as an artistic move. They were like, wow. I mean, they wouldn't think that you'd be the first person to write about it from that perspective. And then I think about the Yinga Dew book, the narrative, the Anacoona, where you selected to write about a historical figure who a lot of people don't really know much about. And so I was wondering, is there something about that kind of, you know, that you don't like to be predictable, or that you are kind of looking, even in situations that people find it would be easy to read, that you're looking for something quite different than what's available at a first read of the narrative? In other words, I almost feel like you're really looking at the hardest issues, but then you twist them one step further.
Well, I'm just curious. I think I have a great curiosity about these things, and then I start looking into them, and these trends suggest themselves. But sometimes it just comes out of the, you know, just a small encounter. You know, I was once invited to a high school. You know, the Dew Breaker, that was one of the sparks. I went to a high school in South Florida, in an area where a lot of like the core of the Haitian military sort of relocated itself.
Yikes.
Yeah, and so I was invited by a charming young girl, and she, you know, after the went to her class, had a nice chat, and after she was, oh, you know, mon papa était militaire, like, you know, my father was in the military, and very casual, and then so we start talking about the time, and then I start placing her father, and it was such, like, this bizarre thing, like sort of the adoring daughter, and then this picture of this man who, because it's a small country, you can actually pinpoint different individuals or groups of individuals, and so different, you know, encounters like that, things, you know, like I think would spark, you know, the deeper historical question. For example, with the Farming of Bones, that started with I met an artist. We're writing, doing those catalogs of Haitian art that you mentioned, and there was one artist who, Antonio Joseph, whose grandmother had survived the massacre, and he would paint, like, all his paintings of the massacre would have all this text at the bottom, you know, and he would write in sort of in red ink, my grandmother crossed this river, and it was like this painting, but this, you know, narrative at the bottom, and we were having a conversation, and that one painting that sort of sparked that interest, he goes, my grandmother used to say that the Massacre River runs with blood. And the river there's one of many rivers that splits the Dominican from the Republic from the Haitian side, is actually called the Massacre River. Before this massacre, because of a massacre of French and Spaniard, you know, colonists who massacred each other there. So just things like that will, and then we'll just pause, and you just, you know, will. But it's a historical curiosity, and also maybe it's this desire to rewrite for ourselves here, you know, this history. Because a lot of, you know, people like my generation or younger may not read in French. They may, you know, they may not read in Creole, right. And so, you know, getting to that is a lot harder. So for me, it's almost a re-entry, you know, of just enlarging the bits that you still have, you know, of recreating that here for ourselves, you know, for memory.
Well, that actually, you know, to stop that for a second, just ask you a direct question about that. Is that why the young adult books, like, what brought you to those narratives? Because even in those narratives, it's like, completely unpredictable. I would never have guessed you would have written about the things you wrote about in the young adult books. Is there, because you feel a really strong desire that you want to reach young people when they're young? You know what I mean? Like,
well, yeah, the young adult books are, I mean, in the beginning they felt like, I mean, I had this experience of arriving in the United States at 12 and not, and just, you know, we, it was 1981, and how did I see myself? How did we see ourselves as a community at that time? People were just talking about AIDS, and we were one of the groups, you know, Haitians, hemophiliacs, homosexuals, they had sort of the high-risk groups. And so this, it was a, when you went to school with the, you know, there were people in the building where we lived in who were fired from their jobs because people didn't understand, they didn't know what it was, so they would, you know, if they were working in somebody's home, they were fired. So that whole, and then the whole first wave of people were coming by boat to Miami. So that was sort of reflected, that was what was being reflected back to me. So I was always looking for things to read about myself. And I remember that sort of that search, that concrete search, and then going to the Brooklyn Public Library and trying to find those books, you know, in French. And that's what I started reading Haitian authors, because in school, at that time, you weren't really taught Haitian authors. We were taught French authors, you know, you
right.
read. So the, so I went back and tried to read those books to find a little bit of me that was different than sort of than that news, you know, than the AIDS, than the boat people, all that stuff that the children were really torturing you with. So I feel like, you know, those books, I feel like unlike my other books, have more of an agenda, have that agenda that a child can see themselves positively, not positively like in a celebration, but they could see a piece of themselves in something, you know, if they're in their Haitian. So that's a very specific thing that I'm trying to do with the books, that I hope to do with them. And also the fact too that I would meet, you know, 10 or 12 year olds who said, "Oh, I read Breath Eyes Memory," and I would be, "Oh,
wow."
No. So
yeah.
that and
a
I
a little rough.
Yeah, I was a little nervous. So now when they said, I could say, "Oh, just start with those other, you know, start with those two first and work your way up to Breath Eyes Memory at 21.
Oh, wow. Well, you know,
no, I mean, they could read it much sooner, but the you know, but it 12 year olds, it makes me a little nervous.
Well, yeah, man. So y'all remember Breath Eyes Memory? 10 years old? Damn.
Yeah.
Well, but I was actually curious about why Anacaona, because I think it's an... This is an interesting place to talk about it in some way, because, you know, one of the foundational myths of kind of the Mexican, the kind of Aztlan is, you know, the name is everywhere. It's the Malinche, know, La Malinche, which is this figure who is this hybrid figure who ends up being someone who in some ways gets associated with the European, you know, conquistadora, you know, the conquest. And Anacaona represents an entirely different, and I was wondering what drew you, what about her, and maybe you wanted to talk a little bit about her for people who are not familiar with this figure.
Mm-hmm. Well, Anacaona was one of the, I mean, there were many Taino female leaders, but one of the first, you know, hugely successful indigenous female leaders in the region, in our region. And we had that conversation where both of our sides, you know, claim her very strongly, you know, geographically. Like, she's Dominican. No, she's Haitian.
She would be like, "Screw you both, go back."
So she, but it's, I became interested in her because she, at least as we, you know, we believe, unless we're proven, it's proven otherwise by some huge archaeological dig.
Right.
we believe that she's from, that the town where her sort of region was, is, that this area is also where my mother's family's from. So I grew up hearing that, you know, Anacaona this, Anacaona that. And actually when I was in Haiti once with, you know, with my husband in one of our trips, and we were driving in that area, and I was writing the book. I had like a little bit of it at home, and it turns out that our car broke down in front of the Anacaona police station, and Leo Gunn. And so I said, oh, it's a sign. I'm meant to write this. But in my mother, in the town where she was born and grew up, there's the Anacaona school. Everything is called Anacaona, you know, and I'm sure it is in many places in the DR. So I always heard that, those stories, and then started, you know, looking into, you know, factually her stories and the difficulty of that, you know, of being between the, you know, that sort of the trying to manage that whole, the European conquest with, and she was, Anacaona, many others had been killed off, you know, her brother, her husband, and all the others in, of her stature, and that society had been killed off by the time she was killed, about 29 years old, and she was betrayed, like, you know, she was told she was coming to a ceremony, and she was hanged. And they did it out of respect. Usually they burn. They would burn. She would have been burned, except she was hanged out of respect for her stature. And so this whole, you know, her myth was just so strong. And so, and I wanted to write it in that way, just explore it. And I was asked to do it in a very interesting way, because there's this the Royal Diaries that Scholastics does, and they do. It's a kind of these short fictional diaries of regal people from all around the world. Right. And so I like the idea of, like, of a child just stumbling upon her if they get the whole kit, you know, and they go, who is this woman? And then there she is, and she just sneaks in there into the regaldom of this series, you know.
Right. Yeah, and it, I mean, for me, it was so weird. You know, the things that you learn if you leave your neighborhood, like I had never heard of La Malinche before I went to college. Mm-hmm. And it was this real interesting thing, because, like, Anacaona, at least as historically understood, when the Spaniards, you know, captured her and, you know, they're gonna kill her, they offered her, they said, well, if you marry a Spaniard, we'll forgive everything. Mm-hmm. And she was like, yo, fuck Spaniards, burn me, you know? And that's a very different kind of narrative of resistance than, oh, let's have half-breed children, and, you know, I'll help you translate. And I think in Dominican Republic, this was always in the air as this kind of, whether it's factual or not, but I think because of the amount of times the island was invaded by Americans, we needed someone who said no. Like, desperately, I think. The Caribbean was very, very desperate for someone like that. So.
No, absolutely. And I think the because also we still have people who can't afford to say no.
Exactly.
In the present moment, you know, so that even if we look back and rewrite that, it's like, I mean, obviously she didn't, you know, she didn't make certain concessions.
Right.
You know, she stood firm. And I think it's also wonderful to think that the founding, you know, there's so many deceits, there's so many horrible things along the way from then to the present. It's important to know that the founding of your land was based on some strong principles, on some strong person's ideal. And I think that's why we cling to people like that, and we cling to, you know, heroes of the revolution, resistors to the occupations, and that's why these people remain so important to us even now.
It's wonderful. And I just wanted to ask a final kind of question about, as an artist, especially as an artist of the Haitian diaspora, and given the conditions in the United States after 9/11, given everything that's happened, the change of immigration status, even with today's kind of the president wilding out about what he's going to do for or against immigration, you know, how as an artist have you seen what's happened 9/11, and even more personally, directly, I know some of your family struggles with, what do you see happening to the Haitian diaspora community in this new era? Because in some ways, after 9/11, everything is anew. I mean,
it's even scarier, I think, than people realize. I live now in Miami, and just yesterday, the chief of police in Miami suddenly just recently said, well, since those since those guys who were on those planes, they lived in Miami at some point. Now we're going to seek liberties to go into people's homes and check them. Now, why do you have to be looking for terrorists on the migrant bus that's taking the poor people to work in the strawberry fields? I don't know. But people have given themselves such liberties. And I think that's that hope where, it's scary for the poorest of the poor of the, in the immigrant communities, people who are even too afraid to speak on this. But I think this is the newest development of it for us in Miami. This, they can stop any bus, ask people for identification, and the chief of police defends that very strongly based on, the fact that some of these men live there and so forth. So, it just feels like it's slowly eroding, and people are deported without their families getting to see them. You see it much more in these communities where the immigrants are the newest arrivals, and they're poor, they're the poorest of the poor, even where they come from. So it's something I think that conscious people need to watch. And we're not saying that that everybody should be allowed in and so forth, and that sort of these arguments that people, that everybody goes to. But I think people need to watch, these basic liberties. They're linked to yours as well. I mean, I think because if we just watching all of a sudden this police chief decides that on the basis of that, this is the reason that these certain, these certain interventions should be made, has convinced me that anything could be justified in this era that we live in, that nobody's is exempt. I thought I was exempt, as you said before, this thing happened in my own family, but it woke me up in a way that I think it should wake up others, that we all need to be watchful.
Yeah, I think for me, though, I think for me, the enormous power of Dew Breaker and the enormous power of much of the work that you've done, given what's going on, is that there's some days, and this is not just like a clever conceit, there are some days where it's difficult for me to decide whether the Dew Breaker you're writing about Haiti or you're writing about the new America. And so I find that's what's extraordinary, the kind of reach you have. But folks, I wanted to thank you all this evening. I wanted to thank Edwige Dantakad, the Lannan Foundation, and all of you for making time for being out here. Edwige, of course, will be here to sign books. So thank you so much and have a good night.
Been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwige Dantakad, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcast and the audio archives.